From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. You're listening to Idaho Matters. It's Friday, which means it's time for our reporter roundtable. If you're a regular listener, you know this is when we get you up to date on all of the news that made headlines this last week in our region. And today, our panel includes Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun. Nicole Blanchard is the Idaho Statesman's outdoors reporter. Andrea Olson with EastIdahoNews.com and Logan Finney with Idaho Reports. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday, Gemma.
Thank you very much.
Happy September.
Oh, I know. September 1st. Holy cow. So, Clark, let's start with some lawmakers apparently wanting a special session to be called. So my first question for you, why? And then is there a timeline for when a special session would have to happen?
Yeah, sounds good, Gemma. Thanks. I guess we just couldn't get enough of the legislature, right?
But apparently not.
All kidding aside, this has to do with the presidential primary election that the legislature seemingly unintentionally got rid of earlier this year. And in terms of timing, we're looking at it would be this month. It would be in September. The Republican National Committee has an October 1st deadline that we keep hearing about in terms of getting this situation ironed out, whether we're doing a primary election, whether we're doing a caucus. And so, yeah, it would be this month. It would be before October 1st. And I also want to invite Logan to jump in at the end because I know he's followed this issue and, and he can help clean up anything that I may have missed. But this would be the first time, if it happens, that the legislature calls itself back into session. As Jim, as you remember, I think as most of the roundtable listeners remember, last year, Idaho voters approved an amendment to the Idaho Constitution that will allow the Idaho legislature to call itself back into session upon a written petition of 60% of the members of both chambers. And so that's the Idaho House and the Idaho Senate. And so that's what's happening right now. Two different senators are circulating petitions attempting to get to that 60% figure to call the legislature back into session to address this presidential primary issue. The sticking point is there's a lot of division still within the Republican Party about how we would fix this issue. And so I'm not 100% sure if they'll be able to get to the 60% or not. But if they do get the 60%, that would trigger a special session within 15 days. So if it happens, we're going to be back at the Idaho State Capitol in Boise before we knew it. But just to back up real quickly, earlier this year, the Idaho legislature passed a bill, I think it was House Bill 138. And the way this was advertised and promoted was that it would save the state about $2.7 million every 4 years by moving our March presidential primary election back to May, which is the election date where Idaho has the other primary elections for state offices and legislative races and so forth. But that didn't actually happen. That bill passed, but all it did was eliminate the March date. It didn't actually move it to May. So the legislative session adjourned. We had this problem. The Republican Party met at its summer meeting and decided that, hey, if the legislature doesn't fix this, we're going to do a caucus, which is totally different than a primary election. A caucus is an event where people have to show up in person. That's the only way to do it at a set day, at a set time, for an in-person caucus that may last hours and hours and hours. And that would be totally different than the primary elections that we have been having recently in the state of Idaho, which are just really similar to all the other elections that we have. The polling place is most likely going to be in your neighborhood. You can show up from 8 to 8. You can vote absentee if you want it. But that went away. And so there's basically two different proposals for a special session. Senator Scott Herndon, a Republican from Segal, would like to reinstate the March primary, that earlier date that the legislature was eliminating, basically undoing House Bill 138. The other competing proposal is from Senate President Pro Tem Chuck Winder, a Republican in Boise, who also wants a special session, but he wants to only consider one bill, and that would move the primary election to May. That would basically come through and do the second part of what House Bill 138 was supposed to do. But there's division within the Republican Party on this March date versus this May date. And so I don't know if they're going to get to the 60%. I did call up House Minority Leader, Representative Alana Rubel. She's a Boise Democrat. Mm-hmm. She said she doesn't care March or May. She just thinks it's most important to get the primary election back on either day and not do this caucus. And the big concern with the caucus is that it would really, really, really reduce participation and turnout because of the in-person requirement, because of the fact that it may run several hours. And so that's kind of an introduction. So, Gemma, I can take a pause and see if Logan has anything to add or if you have any other questions about this one before we wrap up the potential special session.
Well, Logan, let me bring you into the conversation, because what have you heard about the actual likelihood then of a special session happening?
Well, Clark did a great job giving an overview of the situation. One of the details with this constitutional amendment that was passed, giving the legislature the ability to call their own sessions, is it's not just 60% of lawmakers who have to agree, it's 60% of each chamber, so both the House and the Senate. These petitions that Clark is talking about have so far, or at least as of a few days ago, had only been circulated among the Senate members. They are hoping to, if they can reach 60% of senators, then they'll ship it over to the House members and see what they would like to do. Us at Idaho Reports, we talked to Representative Judy Boyle earlier in the week, just briefly about this, and she was very skeptical of whether the House would be even interested in coming back. She is currently the co-chair of the Committee on Federalism, which is an interim committee that the legislature runs. And she said just getting the schedule worked out to where just the Federalism Committee members would come to Boise to meet took weeks of scheduling and haggling back and forth. And so she was very skeptical that enough of a critical mass of the House members would be interested in coming back to Boise that even if the senators were able to meet that 60% threshold, she was very skeptical of the House being able to.
So Clark or Logan, answer this question for me. Why doesn't the governor just call them back into session?
He has that option. Logan did a really good job of talking about the potential issue in the House, and I think he's right. It's really unknown of whether the House members would sign on, and that's if they get 60% of the senators. Governor Brad Little does have the ability to call a special session. I reached out to him last week trying to ask about this and didn't hear back. But our reporter Mia Maldonado asked the governor about this a couple months ago back in April. And he said he thinks it's up to the legislature at this point. He would like to see the legislature handle this. So it's kind of maybe a little bit of a staring contest at this point. But, Gemma, you're absolutely right. The governor has the ability to call a special session. But so far, he has not given an indication that he would do so. And a couple months back, he said he thinks this is up to the legislature to solve. So that's the latest that I've heard. And if Logan has any other details, I'll let him step in and finish it up for us.
Nothing super recent, but yeah, I did talk to the governor's spokesperson back in July. And the statement they gave me was, the legislature sets policy related to elections, and voters gave them the power to get to call their own sessions. The statement also said that Governor Little prefers giving Idahoans the ability to cast their own vote, and he's a proponent of an election system that encourages people to participate. But he really seems comfortable leaving this in the legislature's hands. And honestly, that makes sense, because this constitutional amendment was brought in basically, you know, largely as a result of the pandemic. A lot of lawmakers were very, very critical of the governor's approach to COVID-19 mitigation and policies that were put into place, and really clamored for this power to check the governor if they needed to. And so it is it's kind of an interesting situation where they have this power now, but they have not decided to use it so far.
Okay. Well, I appreciate all of that information. Nicole, I want to bring you into the conversation, because sticking with this Republican lawmaker theme, you recently wrote an article in regards to how there's, I guess, some bit of infighting maybe within the Idaho Republican Party in terms of some folks just getting tired of their party censuring them. Can you talk a little bit about this?
Sure, Gemma, that's right. And, you know, this isn't a completely new phenomenon, but it came back up in the last couple of weeks because Representative Lori McCann, who is a Republican from Lewiston, was censured by Latah County, one of the three counties where she has constituents. And they were censuring her over several votes from this last session, including her refusal to vote in favor of bills that would have made it possible for people to sue libraries over what they considered harmful or obscene materials. That was one of the bills that a lot of folks were censured on. That summer Republican convention that I believe Clark mentioned, the party circulated a vote to provide a vote of no confidence in more than a dozen people, including Governor Brad Little. And so Lori McCann made a statement that she's really, you know, tired of these censures. She's tired of what she has said is a libertarian factor or faction that is kind of coming in and pushing more extreme views. And so I spoke with her and with Republican Representative Matt Bundy of Mountain Home about their experiences being censured. And both of them expressed that they feel like it is driving a wedge between Republicans and forcing them to consider voting in a way that they don't think their constituents want them to vote.
Mm. Okay. So, Andrea, let's head over to Eastern Idaho. Can you talk to us about why a Clark County Library Board official has been arrested?
Yeah, so she allegedly embezzled up to $50,000 from the library bank account. Her name's Amanda Baker, and she was just charged with felony grand theft on August 24th after she allegedly confessed to the crime to the county sheriff. It's a pretty small county over there. But so she has been part of the Clark County Library Board. She's been the treasurer for about 5 years. And also, we found out that she is on the Clark County School District Board of Trustees. But what ended up happening in court documents explains a moment where she was supposed to pay over $23,000 to a roofer business. They replaced the roof, and she said that she was going to mail them a check. But as of August 7th, that check has still not been mailed. So then the roofer contacted Amanda Baker, and she said that the check was mailed by certified mail and that it would be there. But then she told them later that it had been cashed in California and that it was going to take the bank 30 to 45 days to investigate and return the funds to the library. All in all, what ends up happening is that she ended up going and telling the sheriff's office that she was not using library funds correctly. And she started with small amounts of less than $100. And it was just that easy. So she starts transferring money from the library account to her personal checking account and using the library debit card to withdraw money from ATMs. She also started paying personal bills with the library debit card. And she had told the sheriff that she had been doing this for about 4 or 5 years, is what she believes, and that she may have taken anywhere from $40,000 to $50,000. Wow. And then the sheriff asked her why she was doing it, and she had just said she was just trying to survive, but didn't elaborate on what that specifically meant. And as for the roofer situation, trying to pay those people who replaced the roof, she actually made up the lie, she said, in court documents and admitted she never wrote it because there was just not enough money to cover it. So in the end, she ended up getting charged with grand theft. And we also reached out to the library board for any comment, and nobody got back to us on that. So pretty interesting that happened.
Yeah. Thanks for that update on that. Logan, some state lawmakers met last week, and they met with a company they hired to appraise some of the state's federal lands. And the report said that the federal government is paying Idaho's counties about 8 or 9 times less than it should be. So my first question for you is, what is the company and what exactly did lawmakers ask them to examine?
Sure. This company is called Aon AI. They are based out of Utah, and they describe themselves as real estate developers with an economics background. They have designed this tool for the state of Utah that examines the federal lands. And so Idaho lawmakers asked them to do a little bit of a pilot program here. Lawmakers paid the company $250,000 to examine the federal lands in three counties across the state as part of this pilot program. And what this comes down to is what is called the PILT program, or payment in lieu of taxes. This is kind of a wonky topic, but the people who care about it so much because about 63% of Idaho is federal land and you can't charge Uncle Sam property taxes. So for places like Idaho County or Custer County, where they have anywhere from, you know, 60 to I want to say Custer County is 90% federal lands. They have such a small property tax base there that it makes it really hard for the counties to get enough money to pay for their sheriff or for the basic services that their constituents need. So Congress recognized this in back in the 1970s, and they set up this PILT program, payment in lieu of taxes. And so what that is each year the Department of Interior is paying counties, basically it's supposed to be replacement money for what they would be getting in property taxes if that land was in private hands. But if you think of what it would take to appraise an entire national forest, that is a huge workload. And so it hasn't really been based on any sort of actual appraisals in that program. And as well, the distributions are also based on kind of a sliding scale of population and of acreage. So it's a situation where counties with small population and a lot of federal land get paid less than a dollar per acre, whereas places like Ada County, where we have a lot of population, Ada County gets over $3 an acre for their federal lands. And so Western policymakers, because out here in the West is where the majority of federal lands are, they have said that, yes, the PILT funding is incredibly essential and a vital lifeline for these rural counties, but we're getting far less than we should be if this was actually one-for-one replacement of what property tax dollars would be.
So why is it not uniform, Logan, with counties not getting the same amount of money?
Like I mentioned, it's this sliding scale where it's kind of a couple different factors. If you look at, for example, Lewis County up outside the Lewiston area, they have very, very, very little public land in that county. It is mostly in private hands up there. So they don't get very much money from PILTs, but the money that they do get is a higher rate because of the population that they have there. Mm-hmm. And so there's kind of been this criticism for a while that the PILT system and formula is outdated and needs updating. But the reason that Idaho lawmakers and Utah lawmakers have hired this company Aon AI to do these sort of analysis is to actually have some sort of hard numbers to bring to the federal government and say, you guys aren't paying us your fair share, because without actual evidence and actual numbers to back up their arguments, this has been a really theoretical argument so far.
So is everyone on board then with this analysis?
The lawmakers who commissioned it are very, very excited about it. And it's not just a report that Aon AI put forward. They designed a whole data dashboard that the lawmakers are able to use. And so they, if the lawmakers want, they could look at specific pieces of property and compare what the counties got in PILT payments versus what Aon AI says a private owner would pay in property taxes there. And really, it's pretty impressive, the little preview of it that I saw last week. However, not everyone is on board. Part of the contention here is Aon AI admits they're real estate developers, and part of their analysis also included evaluations of if this property was developed to its, let's say, its maximum potential use, like put housing on it, for example. They also calculated what the property tax yield would be there. And so conservation groups like the Idaho Conservation League and others are concerned that this sort of analysis might encourage rapid development in part of these parts of the state. Mm-hmm. However, the land is, of course, federally controlled, but people, certain conservation folks are concerned that having a developer's eye looking at this would encourage further land development.
Mm-hmm. Nicole, let's go back to 2016 when a Treasure Valley man went missing. He was hiking in the Sawtooths, and we have an update now, so many years later.
We do. So this hiker's name was Jack Thomas. He was from Nampa, and he had been hiking in June of 2016 out of the Atlanta area in the Sawtooth National Recreation Area. So that's about 60 miles east of Idaho City, kind of between Idaho City and Galena Summit. And he was on a 4-day hike off of the Queens River trailhead, and he just never turned back up. There was about 2-week search effort from the Boise County and Elmore County officials looking for him, and they never found any evidence that he was still in the area. His family, I think, worked with a nonprofit called the John Francis Foundation to try and find mm-hmm. him, and still had no luck. And then just by happenstance, some backpackers in July were up near a lake called Benedict Lake. So it's about 10 miles northwest of Atlanta. And they happened to find a pair of pants and realized that was pretty strange. Started looking around the area. They were a little ways off trail and found a hiking boot. And then started finding some other personal effects. So they found the contents of a wallet and realized that this was stuff that had belonged to Jack Thomas. Mm-hmm. So they reported that information to authorities. It turns out that this was just over the county line in Boise County. And so the Boise County Sheriff's Office had to hire outfitters. This was pretty far in the backcountry. It was about a 20-mile horseback ride in to find the area that these backpackers had found these personal effects. And searchers were able to find some remains of Jack Thomas. He had a prosthetic medical device in his knee, and they were able to use the serial number from that to match his remains. And so it's bittersweet. His family obviously has some closure after 7 years. Mm-hmm. But yeah, obviously, you know, upsetting to learn that that was his fate.
Yeah. But at the same time, as you said, Nicole, to just probably finally know what happened and have some closure on that has got to mm-hmm. hopefully give families some relief. So Clark, some interesting data out on wildfires and their causes. Let's talk about the majority of the causes that were found, at least in our region.
Yeah, for sure. Kind of an interesting and upsetting phenomena going on right now. But officials with the Idaho Department of Land say they're dealing with a significant increase in human-caused fires on lands that the Idaho Department of Lands is responsible for protecting. And interestingly, in neighboring Washington State, officials there are facing a similar issue. Where they're saying 82% of the fires that they've investigated this year in Washington State were caused by humans. Similar numbers in Idaho.
Wow.
These numbers are a couple of weeks old at this point, but the Idaho Department of Lands was investigating 152 human-caused fires in Idaho just this year so far. 152 human-caused fires compared to just 46 fires caused by lightning. And so I heard about this at a land board meeting, and then I called up Josh Harvey, who's the Idaho Department of Land's Fire Bureau Chief. And I asked him what the heck is going on. And he said, most people don't intentionally do it, but we have had, as you all know, a huge increase in the number of people out and about camping, recreating, enjoying our forests and our public lands in Idaho. And one of the biggest issues that they're running into is people not dousing their campfires and having those 100% completely dead out and then abandoning them. And when I talked with Josh Harvey about this, he said that it's really incumbent on the public to take those extra steps to make sure that your fire is out. He talked about bringing a large capacity multi-gallon jug and a shovel and dousing your campfire over and over again, digging, stirring it, turning all the embers over, and then dousing it with water again. And he had a tip that he shared. And I want to remind people to be careful when they do this. But he said, if you're wondering, and if you have any doubts about whether your campfire is actually out, think about whether you would put your hand in the ashes and touch the ash with the back of your hand. If you wouldn't do that with confidence, your fire is not out. And you need to do more work to keep dousing it with water, digging it, sorting through it, turning everything over, making sure you really get those all of those embers doused out. He said that in their investigations, when they talk with people who have unintentionally caused these fires, they were swearing up and down that they did everything that they could. But it sounds like that the Department of Lands is pushing education. They're pushing more diligence. They're saying people really need to be paranoid almost in the state of Idaho because we have these hot, dry conditions mixed with some winds that sometimes come up in the afternoon. And they've talked about a day or two after people leave, thinking they've had their campfire totally out, a day or two later, wind could whip up an ember and cause a fire. They've also talked about going and studying campsites after people have left and finding and detecting heat like 12 inches below the surface of where the ashes were. So talk about that due diligence. Talk about bringing a lot of water with you when you're out and camping, digging, dousing it. But then would you put your hand in there? If you don't have confidence that you would do that, your fire is not out. You need to do more work to get all of that heat out of there. And Josh wanted me to remind folks that if you ever do put your hand in the ashes, keep in mind that the rocks around your fire pit and the metal part of the fire pit can still be dangerously hot for a long time afterwards. So it's more of a mental thing to really have confidence. But yeah, a huge increase in human-caused fires that we've been seeing in Idaho and Washington, and a lot of it is folks who are maybe newer to the outdoors, or maybe they're in a hurry, or maybe they're not paying attention, or they get lazy, but really kind of an alarming, more than 150 human-caused fires. That's three times the number of lightning-caused fires. And so I know we've talked about fire safety a lot on the program and fire danger in the West and the risk that we have. And so when you add human-caused fire and the human element to it, I know that that can be upsetting and dangerous, and one more thing to be aware of out and about on our public lands. So just a couple of good tips to remember, but more of a wake-up call, really, to really be aware of how dangerous and how dry things can get, even with the rains that we've seen. Still high fire conditions, high fire risk for the remainder of the summer and fall, Gemma. So just a wake-up call for folks out there, especially if folks are heading out and about to enjoy this Labor Day weekend.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Nicole, speaking of folks loving the outdoors, Jump Creek Falls, they're looking at maybe making folks pay to be able to hike there?
They are. So that is an area out by Marsing that is managed by the Bureau of Land Management, and they put together a report that noted just huge increases, as Clark said, in people coming out and recreating there. The most recent numbers that they had available were 2020, and things had more than or nearly doubled from, I want to say, 2016. They said there are about 41,000 visits to the site that year. And as we know, since 2020, people have been going outside even more, so that number is likely even higher now. The agency said it spends about $20,000 a year to handle regular site maintenance, so stuff like grading the roads, emptying vault toilets, cleaning up garbage, but they also use that money to clean up litter and graffiti and things that are left around by people using the site. So they proposed a $5 day use fee, which is pretty in keeping with similar sites around the state. And if they do approve that, that would be locked in for 10 years. So it wouldn't be something that's going up every year. And they would also potentially have an option for a $25 annual pass. So if you're somebody who maybe goes out to Jump Creek multiple times, it might be more economical to do the annual pass. But those fees would help pay for all of that maintenance that previously had been covered with grants and deferred maintenance funds. So this would be more of a permanent solution to funding those needs going forward.
Mm-hmm. And do we know, Nicole, when or if they may implement this?
So there is an open comment period right now. I believe it is open through October 2nd. You can find it through the Bureau of Land Management website. This is their Owyhee field office. So you can also look up the phone number there and leave your public comment. And it will probably take a little bit of time after that. So I don't anticipate anything happening right quick. These kinds of things usually take a little bit of time. Mm-hmm. But we'll just have to keep an eye on it and see.
Okay. Andrea, I have about 2 minutes left with you, but I really want to get to this story. There's a new auto repair shop in Pocatello. Normally, we would not report on this. However, the two owners have created a really unique concept. So tell us about this.
Yeah, so two people created a place called U-Turn Garage over in Pocatello, and it provides vehicle owners with the needed tools to fix their cars themselves. So it's this workshop isn't staffed by mechanics. You can just go there, rent out the space, and do your own work there. And they came up with this idea themselves. I've never even heard of it. Apparently there's some places in Rexburg that are like that, but I think it's a really interesting concept. But all you have to do is schedule an appointment, and you can go in this air-conditioned garage. There's a lift in the middle alongside a hoist. And you can also, so you book an appointment and choose a date and time that works. But you can also get the needed parts for your vehicle, and they can get them delivered right to that workshop. So it's just a do-it-yourself kind of thing, and I think it's really an interesting concept.
I think so, too. And I mean, and it's more economical for folks, right? I mean, because there are a lot of people out there who know how to fix certain things on their own cars, but if, you know, not most people don't have a lift in their garage.
Yeah, correct. And I mean, this probably would not be helpful for me because I don't know how to do that, but my husband knows how to do those types of things. So he said he would definitely use it. And I think it's cool because it's fairly cheap. And they're saying that their costs end up being cheaper than hiring a mechanic and maybe faster too. I would probably be there all day if I was doing it.
Oh, I'd be there for like a week and then, you know, crying because I wouldn't know what to do and how to fix it. And I probably would have caused more damage to my car. So anyway, but for those people who know what they're doing, it's a great idea. I just thought it was such a neat concept. So yeah, appreciate you talking to us about that. I want to thank all of you for joining us today. So appreciate our reporter roundtable. A big thank you to Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun, Nicole Blanchard with the Idaho Statesman, Andrea Olson with EastIdahoNews.com, and Logan Finney with Idaho Reports over at Idaho Public Television. Appreciate all of your work. Guys, have a great Labor Day weekend. And again, appreciate you taking time out of your day.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now, we're taking center stage. Introducing NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, a collection of Black-led stories from NPR's podcasts. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get your podcasts.